This is Base Pairs, the podcast about the power of genetic information.
Great scientific challenges transcend national frontiers and national prejudices, for the language of science has always been universal.
Hey everybody, I'm Brian.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is our fourth chat episode, fifth maybe, I don't know. But regardless, it is about a really cool episode we just had, which was an episode about eugenics. So what is eugenics, Andrea?
Eugenics is basically the idea of good breeding or good genes. And that might sound like a good thing, but it turned out to be a very, very destructive thing.
And you say turned because this is actually history. This is American history and not too long ago either.
Right. We're talking about, you know, the early 20th century, especially the American eugenics movement really peaked around the 1920s. And that's when laws that made it legal to force people to undergo these surgeries that prevented them from being able to have children started going on. And it was all in the name of, you know, improving the gene pool in the country and making sure that these defective genes did not get out into our society, basically.
And now in this modern age, we've got a means to improve gene pools, again, very efficiently, very cheaply, and most importantly, accurately.
Right. For those of you who may not know, there's this totally revolutionary genome editing tool called CRISPR that makes it possible to make very precise changes to DNA. But what's, you know, the issue that people are really talking about with using CRISPR in human embryos in particular is, what does it mean to be able to have this precise control over whether your baby is going to have the gene for a particular disease, or if we get to the point where we can pinpoint certain genes for, say, intelligence, what if we can make sure that an embryo has those? And that sounds like completely new territory. And that's really how I was thinking of it before I talked to Dave.
That's Dave Miklos, the executive director of the DNA Learning Center here at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory.
Yes, and he knows a lot about eugenics because he was the creator of the online eugenics image archive, which you can go check out at eugenicsarchive.org. But that, as you can imagine, has really changed how he looks at a lot of things, having all this historical knowledge. And even things that we've come to kind of take for granted in our society right now, like, you know, in vitro fertilization, it's pretty common practice. He really changed the way that I think about it.
Hearing all of these ethical discussions about, you know, having more control over the human genome than ever with CRISPR gene editing, what goes through your mind as you're hearing these discussions? I mean, you've talked a little bit, like, so many things are the same about these times. I mean,
oh, well, everybody's going to do it.
Yeah.
Whatever technology becomes available for parents to do better for their children, parents will do. 100%. It's been that way forever. And your parents want to give you certain kinds of lessons and help you be good at piano or voice or dancing or whatever. Yeah. They did whatever they could to give you a better life, and they would buy you anything. And how about if they had the opportunity to buy you slightly better genes and they had the money? Do you think your parents would have done that?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I mean, forget about the whole difficulty of it.
And, oh, yeah, of course. But if, you know, breast cancer runs in my family, if my mom could have, you know, gone to the doctor and said, make sure my daughter doesn't have the BRCA gene.
And she wouldn't care if it was gene editing or hocus pocus. She would do it because she was a good mother. And that's what parents do, is they take care of their kids. So, of course, if there's technology that could make your kid suffer less or prosper more, any parent will do that. So to say that people aren't going to make use of genetic technology is a lie. You know, a great example of, like, we have lots and lots of people now delaying childbirth. And because of that, more reproductive problems, lots and lots of people doing in vitro fertilization. So let's just take the case where you're fertilizing these eggs and you can know anything about one egg over the other. So let's say that there's 6 fertilized eggs there. You come from a family that might have a history of breast cancer. You're certainly not going to take any of those fertilized eggs that the data suggest might carry breast cancer. You'd be a fool to take any of those, right? And of course you wouldn't. Well, but how about if you could know just a little more information about any one of those 6 eggs? Like there's a combination of genes in this egg, egg number 1, that have to do with developing your nervous system. And we're not sure exactly how it works, but they could make your nervous system go together better, develop better, function better. Maybe give you a smarter person. Knowing that egg number 1 had that better combination of genes that just might give your kid an advantage but not cause harm, would you just ignore that information and just say, no, I'll just take a random selection. Just close my eyes and I'll select one. No, of course you have to, as a parent, choose that. So to think that anyone's not going to use genetic technology when it becomes available, there may be laws initially and people will have these moral problems about it. But the only real moral problem with having a better child is, when does the technology become so expensive that it just becomes one more way of disadvantaging people?
Damn.
Right, it's hard hitting though.
That is super hard hitting. I mean, I can't argue with it. I can't. I know I think about my own parents and I'd say, of course they'd do that. Any parent would do that. There's always this line, right? That we all, anybody draws a moral line somewhere. And if there's one thing that will make you push that line, we see it in movies, we see it in books, we see it in real life, is that if it's for the sake of your kids.
Right. It really, it's hard to argue with that. But then you have to think about it at the societal level. You know, if everyone's making choices like that, what does it mean? Or if only a select group of people, like Dave was saying, like very wealthy people, get to make that choice, what does that mean? And that's something that really came up in my conversation with Miriam Rich, who is the CSHL Archives Sydney Brenner Research Scholar for 2017 to 2018. And she really helped put in perspective what kinds of warning signs we need to be looking out for when we have these conversations, and especially these conversations that talk about what kinds of traits are desirable and which are not, and who gets to decide that.
So I think, you know, any conversation that is sort of predicated on or trading in this idea of identifying, you know, some traits as desirable and others as not should really be extra aware of this history and sort of have a heightened awareness of the potential for those designations to entrench existing prejudice.
Right. I think about the example of deaf people and, you know, a lot of people who are not so familiar with the deaf community might say, if we can fix deafness with CRISPR, for some people at least, you know, people who have genetic conditions that lead to deafness, you know, then that's great. Like, we should do that. But a lot of people in the deaf community would not argue that their deafness is an impairment at all, and in fact would say that it's something that enhances their lives.
Yeah, I think that's a really powerful example. And certainly there have been, you know, critiques from a variety of disabilities communities about just that issue of certain types of disabilities being labeled as impairments or something in need of correcting by certain discourse and not recognizing them as in fact sort of human variants that can be accommodated by and in fact enrich a society.
So would you say that, you know, like ultimately it has to be a personal decision about how a particular technology or procedure that will affect someone's reproduction, like it just always has to be at the personal level, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's probably more complicated, just because even if sort of the use of reproductive technologies are personal choices, sort of the conversation around them and the assumptions people make can contribute to a climate in society or to a prevailing, you know, vision or perspective in society that affects how people living with, for instance, disabilities are treated. Even if sort of the widespread use of reproductive technologies is something that's framed as individual choice, it's still affecting the society that everyone lives in.
Yeah, so again, this is another heavy thing to think about, and it kind of works with what Dave was saying, which is we might start entrenching certain cultures or groups associated more so with disability, maybe because they don't have the means to support disability or because they don't have the means to avoid disability. Basically, if groups of people can't afford genetic screening and other groups can, is disability going to become a burden of the poor?
Yeah, not only does disability become solely a burden of the poor, but do, you know, the wealthier people in our society get to decide which disabilities are truly an impairment, which, as I've learned, many people in the deaf community do not see deafness as an impairment, even though it is a disability. And, you know, with a sufficient amount of support, you know, things like putting captions on your videos, putting
something
up the trans...
Do.
Yes, something we do. Putting up transcripts of your podcast, these sorts of things. You know, if these communities get smaller and smaller and these ideas become more entrenched that, you know, this is an impairment, something to be gotten rid of, you know, what are we losing there?
And obviously, we don't have answers. You know,
no.
We're kind of trying to look to the future and going, okay, if this happens, then what kind of thing? But in this case, we're almost gadflies. We're like Socrates right now. We're just poking holes into potential problems without any solutions on hand. But if anybody wants to tell us what they think, please comment on our podcast. Let us know. We'll love to hear from you. Even tweet at us. It's at CSHL.
All right, everyone. Thanks for thinking some really deep thoughts with us. It's been fun and eye-opening.
I always love conversations like this, and I hope we can have more of them here on Base Pairs. We've got one more episode this season.
We do.
Just one, and it's going to be about classification. And I know that sounds really boring, stamp collecting, ugh, but it's not, I swear.
Yeah, classification is identity. It's who, you know, what these things are. What is the identity of...
Spoilers! Okay. So...
Yeah, just stay tuned. We're coming to you from Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, a private, not-for-profit research and education institution at the forefront of molecular biology and genetics. So if you'd like to support the research that goes on here, you can find out how to do that at cshl.edu.
And feel free to pay us a visit. Between our undergraduate research program, high school partnerships, graduate school, meetings and courses, the DNA Learning Center, and public events, there really is something for everyone.
I'm Andrea.
And I'm Brian.
And this is Base Pairs. More science stories soon.